Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle.
I'm not a golfer, but when I received an invitation to attend the annual King Hassan II Pro-Am Golf Tournament in Morocco, as one of six North American journalists, how could I refuse? This was the real deal. An invitation arrived in the mail, topped with an official Royal Islamic Star, a gold seal with fancy French calligraphy. A week later, first-class tickets arrived for passage from JFK to Marrakesh aboard a chartered Royal Air Maroc Boeing 747. The first inkling that this journey would be an out-of-the-ordinary experience occurred just prior to liftoff. With drinks in hand, people casually strolled the aisles. It was cocktail party central in first class. Some, myself included, sat on armrests talking to pros and amateur seatmates. A large linen-draped trolley topped with a bouquet of fresh flowers graced the front of the cabin. There was no pre-flight announcement, no stow your tray tables, no seat backs up, buckle up, extinguish your laptop, and mobile phone directives. The flight attendants blithely ambled about, champagne flutes in hand, as the turbines rolled to full military power. The behemoth aircraft rotated and we were airborne, and hardly anyone was seat-belted. As the craft nosed skyward, we amusedly watched the flower cart careen madly down the aisle. After landing in Marrakesh, we were whisked straight through customs without a moment's pause for suitcase inspections. We were guests of the king. Curbside, two buses idled, along with police, motorcycle, and squad car escorts standing by. Wherever we went during our 10-day stay, a security detachment clung close to the buses, along with plainclothes Secret Service agents. Ahmed, one of the King of Morocco's senior Secret Service agents, and I became instant buddies. We just clicked. A couple even commented that they thought he was my older brother. Every day, primarily for the golf widow's entertainment, bus excursions were offered to historic destinations such as Casablanca, Fez, Tangiers, and the Caves of Hercules. Each morning as I'd enter the hotel's lobby after breakfast, there was Ahmed, dapper and professional looking, with a gracious smile of welcome. He'd approach, put his arm around my shoulder, hold my hand, and ask, "Where you go today, Tom?" I would then inquire about his bus escort assignment, and if I liked the sound of his trip better than my pick, I'd hop on Ahmed's bus. It was a relationship where it wasn't the content or the intensity of conversation that made the friendship so special. It was the unspoken, intangible elements. You know, that comfortable sense you instantly get from certain people just met. The feeling that you might have been best buddies in a past life, or at least a confident sense of knowing them from somewhere, sometime long ago. That's the way it was with Ahmed and me. One day, following the entourage's relocation to Rabat, I joined Ahmed's group for a visit to Fez. As we walked along the narrow alleyways of an ancient souk, I sensed a particular, scary-looking, bearded man with tattered clothes and a pathetically worn-out, grease-stained baseball cap. We'd round a corner in the donkey-dung-littered marketplace, and out of the corner of my eye, I'd spy the mutant, slithering once again amidst the crowd. For the longest time, I just knew in my heart that this guy was up to no good. But late in the afternoon, I observed one of the suits whispering clandestinely to the freaky guy. That's when I realized he was one of Ahmed's moles. One particular warm afternoon in Rabat, Ahmed approached me in the lobby. He asked if I'd like to go with him as he escorted Doreen, the mother of the pro from Cork, Ireland, and a wealthy Mexican couple attending as amateur golfers. We headed to one of Rabat's Medina marketplaces. "Sure," I said, "I'll grab my camera and meet you at your car." Ahmed careened high-speed through the streets of Rabat, navigating the steering wheel of a Citroën with casual abandon. Our journey was serenaded by the slow, methodical chants of the muezzin's evening calls to the faithful. Competing chants emanated from tiny loudspeakers mounted atop dozens of neighborhood minarets. Inside the walled medina, the atmosphere was festive but relaxed. The market brimmed with piled-high carpets, fresh and dried fruits, oranges and lemons, glistening brassware, silk scarves, and leather goods, along with daggers and Bedouin swords dangling from the open-air stalls. Ahmed was a master haggler, and he knew the real value of the goods being tendered. I discovered this as I started to hand a shopkeeper a $20 bill for a curved Bedouin dagger. Ahmed held my hand back and barked out a few Arabic sentences. He then turned to me and said with a checkmate grin, "The shopkeeper says he will accept $8. One shop in particular caught my attention with its array of glistening hammered tin and brassware. At the rear of the shop, seated on a tattered stool, was an elderly man. He puffed peacefully on a hookah. I wanted to take a picture of him, but I thought it prudent to ask Ahmed first, since both men would be prominent in the shot. "Yes, of course, no problem. You shoot, Tom." As I clicked off three or four frames, the zigzag man smiled faintly while the young guy just stared blankly, but then quickly yanked his face away from the lens. As he did so, I noticed an icy coldness to his gaze. We walked on and turned a corner in a narrow corridor of the open-air section. To visualize our locale, imagine the marketplace scene from the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Most everyone encountered looked very peaceful with sublime expressions, but there were a few denizens whose behavior and expressions raised little alarms in my head. But I gaffed it all off as alien cultural mannerisms. But that's not how my travel mate, Miss Noreen from Cork, interpreted the situation. This was her first journey beyond the pale. But by all outward appearances, she was remarkably relaxed throughout her medina walkabout. But now, when I turned to ask her how she was doing, she looked semi-paralytic. "Noreen, are you all right?" I asked. "No, I don't think so," she announced meekly. "Is it safe here, Tom? Are you sure it's okay?" she asked with a bird-like Celtic lilt. "Of course it is, Noreen," I answered confidently. I then turned to Ahmed for reassurance. "Ahmed, tell Noreen how safe it is here." Ahmed stood at attention as he looked at Noreen's eyes and proudly proclaimed in a fatherly tone, "Noreen, I could leave you two here at midnight, and I assure you nothing bad would happen." Not more than a minute later, Ahmed turned to me and said, "Tom, if you excuse me for a moment, I should like to go talk to my friend in a shop over there." And Ahmed stepped into a stall a few feet away, and we caught snippets of his pantomime conversation with his friend, local date and almond specialist. Just as I turned to comfort Noreen, a curly black-haired man who walked with a scrunch and looked very much like a severely pissed-off Groucho Marx on LSD roared straight up to me. He looked at my camera with pure hatred, pointed at my chest, and then glared at me as he waggled his index finger in my face. "You have camera. I have gun. I come back and shoot you in face." Whereupon he vaporized into the crowd of peaceful, fez-capped, caftan-draped late afternoon shoppers. Not more than 10 seconds later, Ahmed reappeared, and he sensed something was akilter. He glanced at me and asked, "Is everything all right, Tom?" "No, Ahmed, actually it's turning out to be a rather shitty day. A guy just walked up and threatened to shoot me, and then he ran off, I think to go get his gun." "Where is he? Where'd he go? We get him," Ahmed said commandingly. He then wrapped his arm through mine and jerked me from a standstill to full tilt boogie. Instantly, everything went into hyperdrive, a whizzing, whirring, visual panoramic blur. It was like I had just become the lens of a video camera filming my own Technicolor Hollywood action movie. Card tables overturned, shoppers and peddlers drove out of Ahmed's way as we weaved and dodged down the Medina's narrow alleyways. All the time, his right arm tightly interlocked with my left, Ahmed charged ahead like a linebacker, bulldozing the defense, and I the reluctant linebacker. As we hurtled onward toward my rendezvous with doom, I thought to myself, this is absurd. Here I am, being towed by Ahmed toward the very guy who wants to shoot me, and I'm the only one in my movie without a gun. Remarkably, I wasn't scared. The whole situation was unfurling way too fast, and it was all way too surreal. Just then, up ahead, I spotted Groucho turning a corner. There he is, Ahmed. Seconds later, Ahmed tackled the guy, lifted him up by the collar of his olive drab army jacket. He held him aloft with feet dangling in space as Ahmed rapid fire rattled off nasty sounding, spittle charged Arabic utterances. To complete the scene, imagine around 75 timid, incredulous, mouse-like shoppers standing around us in a tightly packed circle, much like spectators watching a junior high lunchtime fight. A moment later, Ahmed drop-kicked Groucho to the ground, pulled out his glistening golden king badge in one hand and his pistol in the other. He shoved them alternately in front of the mutant's face as he continued berating him in spittle-charged Arabic. I imagined that the gist of Ahmed's lecture was something akin to, "You imbecile! You fool! You knave! How could you have insulted a guest of King Mohammed VI? Do you realize how easily you could be shot for such an offense?" As Groucho lay dust-covered at Ahmed's feet with a scared, shitless, but poorly masked, still pissed off expression, Ahmed turned to me and said, "How you say in English? I think he is just loco, crazy, but harmless. If it's all right with you, we let him go, Tom." What the hell was I supposed to say? "No, Ahmed, I don't think so. Shoot him." But I replied, "It's entirely up to you." Ahmed pulled Groucho up off the ground, dusted him off, and sent him scurrying off through the Medina's narrow passageway. And that's the last I saw of Groucho. That is, until we were close to the market's two-story keyhole-arched entrance. I happened to glance into the zigzag guy's stall, and there was my guy, slightly disheveled and dusty, and obviously still severely pissed off. He was lurking in the back of the copper pot and pan and dagger shop, staring at me with utter undiluted contempt. But I felt like calling out, "Dude, you started it." But I just turned away and we walked back to Ahmed's car for the ride back to the Rabat Hilton, where we would don tuxedos and join the King's old friend, Billy Casper, the golf pro, for his entourage as they celebrated Casper's birthday with a feast of mutton and entertainment by horn-blaring and tambourine-rattling Bedouin tribesmen. My wife and I were in Belfast in conjunction with the April 10, 1998 Good Friday Agreement. It was a momentous time in Northern Ireland. The Ulster Unionist Party had agreed to work with the Republicans, but it was by no means the end of the Troubles. Random sectarian killings and firebombings continued, but a sense of peace, hope, and evolution was palpable throughout Ireland. The Royal Irish Constabulary, RUC, Northern Ireland's policing agency, was perceived by many to be staunchly anti-Catholic and anti-nationalistic. Their actions, both overt and covert, lent painful credence to the sentiment. At the time, more than 93% of the police force were members of the Protestant faith. The taint ran so deep that eventually the RUC was dissolved and replaced on November 4, 2001 by a more balanced organization that remains today, the Police Service of Northern Ireland. One of my goals while exploring Northern Ireland back in 1998 was to get inside the RUC. I wanted a face-to-face with the officers to see for myself just how the sectarian bias and hatred had affected the policemen. An opportunity arose while traveling through a historic hotbed of sectarian strife, County Armagh, the location of the annual marching season. I was confident I could talk myself past the blast-proof concertina wire-cap 20-foot-tall perimeter walls of a regional RUC station in Craigavon for a chat with the officer in charge. Craigavon is in the heart of the sectarian neighborhoods that experienced the brunt of the annual marching season when orange men paraded through Catholic neighborhoods beating on humongous lambeg drums. The ancient drums, prideful symbols of the Unionists and the Orange Order, were religiously used in street parades, most notably the 12th of July parade, known as the 12th. We approached the RUC's Craigavon Station street side entry and found a bulletproof window with speaking slits, reminiscent of a theater ticket booth. I slipped my press credential through a slot and asked the sentry if it might be possible to visit with the station's officer in charge. He picked up the phone and a minute later pointed to the mammoth steel entry gate. A buzzer rang and the mammoth steel gate clanked slowly open as the officer instructed us to head across the parking lot to the station. The station, about 30 feet away on the far side of a parking lot, was actually a windowless concrete bunker with a steel blast-proof door that automatically swung open as we approached. Ushered inside the pillbox, an officer led us down a narrow, dimly lit hallway and knocked and opened an office door and introduced us to Sergeant Mike O'Donnell, who smiled with a twinkle in his eye as he rose from his desk and asked, "And who might you be?" I introduced myself, and he asked where we were from. We instantly got on great, and it wasn't long before he opened up and, to my utter surprise, eventually shared some of the RUC's intelligence about upcoming confrontations planned by the Unionists in his precinct. We talked nonstop for an hour or so, and as we rose to say goodbye, he looked me straight in the eye and said, "I thought you might like to know, Tom, that I'm Catholic." I was stunned, as I had arrived with the firm preconception that, of course, the station's highest-ranking officer would surely be a Protestant. It was our last day in Northern Ireland. We checked in at the Stacas Park Hotel in Temple Patrick, County Antrim, and packed for our early morning flight home. I was still digesting how we had managed to become such trusting friends with O'Donnell in such short order, so quickly that I was taken aback by the trust and confidence he had extended to me by sharing his intelligence reports. I remember asking myself, "Good God, I'm a journalist. How would he know I'm not a plant or a spy?" But the unspoken bonds of a trusting friendship had been confidently established, and we left with promises to keep in touch, which we did. When I went downstairs in the morning to check out, I still have the note from the hotel front desk that read, "Please call the RUC." I was freaked, as my first thought was that something awful had occurred, like my dad had died. I immediately called the RUC, and to my surprise, Sergeant Mike O'Donnell answered, "Top of the morning to you, Tom. We thought that possibly you and Beth might like to go out on patrols with us in the Land Rover today." I was stunned and flattered by the incredible offer, but I gave my regrets as we were just minutes from checking out and catching a cab for the Belfast airport. I told Mike, "I'm so sorry. We can't ride along today, but we'll definitely take a rain check for when we next visit." We said our farewells with promises to keep in touch, which we did for quite some time. We wrote periodically, and I will always remember his telephone call of concern to my home in California the morning of the New York City 9/11 terrorist attack. At the time, I was travel editor for Las Vegas Magazine and produced on-air travel shows for NPR affiliate KCBX in California, and I would periodically send copies of the magazine and cassette recordings of my travel shows to Mike. I asked Mike if he was receiving the packets I had been sending, and he responded, "Oh, yes. Actually, my daughters think your radio shows are quite brilliant." Flattered, I asked, "What exactly did they enjoy the most about my shows?" "Oh, they absolutely delight in laughing at your accent, Tom." Mike had told me a bit about the downside of being a Catholic in a predominantly Protestant police force, and the inherent downside of living in a staunchly Catholic neighborhood, where the IRA had a long history of planting bombs on doorsteps, kneecapping, and sometimes killing those they perceived as a threat or a traitor to the cause. Just being a Catholic in the RUC was ample reason to put one on a hit list. Mike had gone to great lengths to mask the fact that he was an RUC man when off duty, especially anywhere in the vicinity of his neighborhood. One time, as I prepared a packet for Mike and his teenage daughters, I copied, without thinking, his home address on the label instead of his police station address as I normally did, and included the header, "Attention, Sergeant Mike O'Donnell." It wasn't until I received a telephone call from Belfast a week after sending the packet that I was struck by the potent deadliness of my absence of thought. Please, whenever you send packets or letters, never use my home address, and definitely never include my title. We think the postman is one of us, but we're not quite sure. Decades later, a shiver still runs down my spine every time I recall the horrific potential that could have transpired from the simple, thoughtless error of including a policeman's title when addressing a postal address label to someone in Northern Ireland, something one would just not think about in America. But it most definitely is something I should have thought of, knowing as much as I did about the social, political realities of life in Northern Ireland, going back in time to the Battle of the Boyne in July 1690. Time passed, and Mike took an early retirement on his 50th birthday, and I eventually, and most regretfully, eventually misplaced his phone number and home address. In 2012, I was invited by the Northern Ireland Tourist Board to attend the 100th anniversary of the launch of the Titanic at Belfast, Harland and Wolff shipyards. Preparatory to departing for Belfast, I contacted the woman who had arranged our visit to the North back in 1998. She was well connected with the most powerful and influential people in Northern Ireland, including the president. I asked her if she might be able to put the word out that I'd like to meet with my old friend, and could she assist with finding his contact information. A week later, she sent an email with regrets. "Yes, Tom, we found Mike. He's fine. But to protect the lives of former officers, we are forbidden by law from releasing any personal details of former RUC officers, especially telephone numbers or addresses. All we can tell you is that he is fine and in good health." And sadly, that was the last glimmer of my connection with Mike O'Donnell. As a postscript, obviously, the name of the sergeant was changed for obvious reasons. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a reminiscence of the day we were in Finland and we went to the Russian border. The Land Rover rumbled and groaned along the rusty, pockmarked dirt road as we approached the Russian border. Although we would never actually see the Russian side of the line, as a broad frontier, no man's land separates the Finns from the Russians. Our driver, Yussi, a scrub-faced 24-year-old Finn, parked the Land Rover across the road from the Frontier Guard Station. The Finnish Army maintains a cadre of guard stations at strategic points along the Russian border. The ever-vigilant Finns have lived through centuries of invasions by the Russians to the east and the Swedes to the west. The 1939-40 Winter War between the Finns and the Russians in the early days of World War II was exceptionally brutal and deadly for the Finnish Army. Many reminders of those dark days in Finnish history remain evident as one travels through the forests along the Russian border. One might mistake the mammoth rocks for an ancient farm fence, but the multi-ton stones were painstakingly placed there as tank traps during World War II. There are remarkably well-preserved, hand-dug trenches reinforced with wooden planks and networks of defensive caves that served as troop hideouts and emergency field hospital. Jussi, dressed in combat fatigues, accented with a hammer and sickle emblazoned Soviet Army belt, hops out of the truck and lights up a cigarette as we amble over to check out the border gate, complete with a yellow-striped horizontal wooden pole and an adjacent sign highlighted with a bright red slashed circle accompanying a litany of verboten activities. Jussi admonishes, not even to think about ducking under barrier, not advised to even put fingers on far side of pole. After milling around and posing for pictures next to the sign delineating the terminus of the free world, we start back to the Land Rover. That's when Bruce, a fellow journalist from Toronto, noticed the Finnish Frontier Army Guard station's obstacle course set in a clearing just off the roadway. The barracks and ancillary buildings, reminiscent of a U.S. National Park Ranger station, are situated in a clearing on the opposite side of the road. A group of soldiers in brown combat fatigues mill around in the shadows of a machine shed at the rear of the facility. They appear to be on a coffee break, but all eyes are discreetly fixed on us, especially on Bruce and Zelda, who has followed in Bruce's footsteps to check out the soldiers' obstacle training course. There is something remarkably innocent and yet intently curious about the soldiers' stares. Their expressions are reminiscent of the inquisitive, semi-perplexed gaze of a deer family when they spot a human. Cooped up in the Land Rover, bounding through the Finnish wilderness for most of the morning, Bruce and Zelda just cannot resist the urge to run the obstacle course. After successfully completing the first set of obstacles that included short hurdles, tunnels, and low-lying barriers, Bruce and Zelda give each other high fives and then look our way with Olympic winner upraised arms and proud smiles of accomplishment. As they ran the course, I noticed that the hurdles, tunnels, and other obstacles were substantially shorter and smaller than I remember from my military basic training, but I assume there was an appropriate explanation for the low-profile attributes of the hurdles, ramps, and catwalks. And then we gaze over toward the Finnish frontier soldiers and notice that they were all pointing at Bruce and Zelda, slapping their thighs and laughing hysterically. You see, why are the soldiers laughing at Bruce and Zelda? Oh, I think they have never seen such a sight before. This obstacle course not for human, these course for dog training only. And so ended a memorable interlude on the Finnish frontier border with Russia.